Where does the end begin? Where does the end end? And what the hell is happening in the middle? These are some of the questions we tackle in this episode as we explore Aardvark Weather, an end-to-end forecasting system. End-to-end models are super cool and likely to be the future of weather forecasting, but they also revitalize old questions about transparency, end-user trust, and the fidelity and availability of raw observations.
We're going to unpack what an end-to-end model is, the Aardvark Weather approach, and how these models at large might shape the landscape of forecasting. And books. Always books. I actually got some emails from friends, like, Kurt from Tennessee Valley Authority email. I was on, like, a chain email of, like, whoa, this is crazy. So definitely made some ripples. But before we introduce the paper, we got some feedback on our last podcast that we forgot to say who we were, which actually I thought that was kind of by design. I thought it was maybe nice to remain in the shroud of mystery and people can guess if we are, you know, PhD meteorologists or or not.
Infer that we have no business making this podcast.
I wonder what they guessed. I have a feeling. So why don't we go around. Alden, why don't you start? Who are you?
Cool. I'm Alden. I come from a traditional tech background. I've trained as a software engineer in college and did machine learning work there, and then was working in industry with Marshall and was really wanting to work on problems day to day that felt more important than the types of kind of traditional tech problems that we're working on. And so Marshall and I started this company, Upstream Tech, where we got to bring together exciting technology and apply it towards environmental problems that were really interesting to us. And fast forward 9.5 years now, we're still working at Upstream
Gross.
Tech.
That's a long time.
It's a really long time. We are officially not a startup. And over that time, spent a good amount of my effort working on modeling river flows. And a huge input into river flows is, of course, weather. And I've been thinking about that quite a bit. The models we use are also machine learning, deep neural networks. So when I saw all this progress happening in the weather modeling with deep neural network space, of course, is very exciting and interesting. Also, I work on something called dynamical.org, which is a nonprofit that helps make the data that comes from these weather models and some of the data that goes into them more accessible and easier to access, because we've just, Marshall and I, over these years have had a very recurring theme of trying to build the thing we want to build and then realizing that just getting the data to start the process is 80% of the work. So dynamical.org is an attempt to make that allow you to jump to the right to the fun part and use data that's ready to work with.
Yes, Alden and I went through formal computer science engineering education, but I am a big believer in the liberal arts and being prepared to learn. I mean, I think that's why we focus so much on books and reading academic papers. So I would say Alden is a journey person meteorologist at this point, if y'all will permit me.
Maybe a hydrologist. We could say that. I'm
okay.
A hydrologist.
Journey person, that. Hydrologist. Sure. Yeah. It's so interconnected, but yeah, that's fair.
But I always say we studied machine learning in college, and that is technically true. But I mean, the machine learning that was happening then is a shadow of what's going on right now.
In defense, though, we like had to hand code the
K-nearest
entire
neighbors.
Learning. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I actually think there's something to be said where folks today are pulling these tools off the shelf. I mean, especially with the layers of prompt engineering counting as AI. I think to have a deep understanding of like how you actually code a loss function, how you could experiment with that, the performance limitations of Python, maybe where you want to like re-implement it in C. I mean, that was the class. And yes, we were implementing maybe more naive approaches looking back now, but those kinds of classifiers and support vector machines, I mean, it was a great foundation to be able to go deeper in even the current state of things.
Yeah. So Marta, where do you come from?
I loved that the question that we got for this was, did we study meteorology in college? And The short answer for me is no. No, I did not study anything even remotely close to meteorology. I think the closest thing was one elective geology course that was in paleoclimatology, and I was obsessed with it because it was about the history of climate change. But it was so sick. It made me think about becoming a geology major, but I didn't. All of my schooling is in environmental studies and the human relationship to the environment and creative writing. So I'm a writer, and I really focus on that human relationship to place and nature. But I started thinking about weather when I was actually writing a lot of fiction. I was thinking a lot about how place generally, climate and weather affect characters. And that really unlocked thinking about how weather affects who we are. And I don't have any relationship to coding either. Hearing Marsh and Alden go through like their background in coding, it's very mystifying to me. But I did start thinking about AI and intelligence more generally when I started working on what is my current writing project, which is focused a lot on animals. And thinking about animal intelligence and intelligence generally got me really stoked to think about how AI challenges what our perceptions of intelligence is, what kind of intelligence we contend with out in the universe other than ourselves. So I like those sort of big questions, philosophical questions, writerly questions.
Me too. I think I fall in between Alden and Marta in terms of my interests. Not that Alden is...
I'm all numbers.
Yeah, Alden is just a robot, and Marta...
And I'm no numbers.
Marta, have you read An Immense World?
No, I haven't.
It's all about animal intelligence, and pretty great.
Yeah, there's a genre of animal writing, and it's definitely impacted that.
Yeah, well, I guess for my introduction, Alden and I have worked almost all the same jobs. We picked straws when we were starting Upstream, and realized that he was better at focusing for long times on hard things, and I was better at moving quickly on less hard things. So now I send emails and he does all the machine learning, which is a sad simplification of truth. But yeah, I'm a computer scientist. I'm not a meteorologist. I do read a lot.
Yeah, but that perspective, you get a different level of height, and that gives a new perspective, which I be able to connect things together that you might overlook if you're way down in the thinking about the exact connections inside some neural network.
Yeah. Yeah, both my parents were in the music industry. My dad is a recording engineer and now puts out music. Check out his album, Into the Microcosm. So my parents were both listening to our first episode and they're like, yeah, it was great. You know, you all sounded smart.
That's what counts.
My dad said it sounded great.
Nice work.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah, that's really all I was trying to achieve. Okay, should we do we have books?
I can start. I can start on our weather report. And should I mash my book into it because it connects?
Yeah, let's do it in one.
Okay, the weather report. Let me start there. It is officially, I would say, summer thunderstorm season, which has been very intense. I think that like the whole East Coast has had really intense thunderstorms recently. And here in Maryland, we've had hail and tornadoes and giant old trees come down, which has been really sad. But thunderstorms are my favorite weather event. I've always said that. And I've had so many experiences recently of really intense lightning and double rainbows that I'm like, I have to start writing this down. So I started keeping a weather journal for about 2-ish weeks now. And every day I write down the weather as I can measure it. So I try like not to look at my phone app, try not to look at the radar, really tune into what I can see and feel and sense. And it's been such an enriching experience, I have to say, and makes me pay attention in a way that is really fulfilling, slows down time for sure. And I also have to say too, like anyone out there that's interested in weather, but is further removed from like the first person observation or any field work, re-engaging with it has been sort of a lesson in like how to process weather events before you start reading headlines and all the data like starts inundating you.
That really resonates with me because for the work we do at Upstream forecasting hydrology, it's cool. It's probably as tangible as I think I can think of getting with technical work around something environmental, like the two products we make, Hydro Forecast and Lens, but it still feels very abstract. And only I have a place I stay at in Western Mass, which has a stream gauge like right behind it. And looking, you know, I guess this isn't quite me perceiving it, but that kind of connection to a single in-situ sensor that I could look at and see the measurements of and make a note of and then go out and connect it to like what I'm seeing in the Green River and feeling as I like walk through the Green River was pretty special. So that's a really cool idea, Marta. Maybe I will start a weather journal as well.
Do either of you have a individual weather station?
I did for a while. And actually, I'm going to talk about that in this paper because It taught me a lot about observations and truth. And I don't want to spoil it. But yes, I did. I moved down to Nashville. I haven't set it back up. But yes, I have had one for many years.
I saw that Wirecutter called a personal weather observation one of the hot top 10 Father's Day gifts. And it made me always think of both of you.
I think I got my dad one. I always recommend it. Yeah, totally a big hit for the weather daddies out there.
I can recommend a book very quickly too that is connected to my weather journaling, though it's not nominally a weather piece of writing. It's called The Forest Unseen. It's by David George Haskell, who's a biologist and particularly interested in forest ecology. And he, for a year, he goes out to one specific, like it's like a 1 by 1 meter patch of old growth forest in Tennessee, and goes out in every weather and chronicles the experience, goes really deep. There's some amazing passages about lichen if you're into that kind of thing. But he calls his sit spot the mandala. It's a microcosm of the macrocosm, not to bring it back to plug your dad's album, but it's essentially in like Eastern philosophies or different contemplative practices, the mandala is a perfect representation of the universe. And I was thinking about what that is conceptually. It's kind of like a model, this sort of relationship between the local and global. And that concept of a sit spot and the mandala has really underscored my practice of weather journaling and going out into the same place every day. I've also been thinking a lot about how it invites us to think globally in the same way that weather does. So really fantastic, really fantastic book.
That is awesome. I feel like I'm just going to be ordering every time we record an episode, ordering the book that you recommend, because that, I mean, being in Tennessee, obviously, that really sounds fantastic. That actually reminded me maybe of an off-the-cuff rec that I'm going to make. I don't know if folks read Harper's Magazine. This is specifically one from the archives not so long ago, but about artificial intelligence. And there's an author, Benjamin Labatou, who's kind of hot right now. He focuses on geniuses that kind of spiral out of control. And he specifically does a really good job weaving nonfiction and fiction together in a way that it's hard to detect as the reader. He has an article called The Gods of Logic, which is one of my favorite pieces of writing about artificial intelligence that I've come across. Especially this came during the glut of AI nonsense writing when ChatGPT was on its like big upswing and all of that. So it weaves together religion, faith, logic, a lot of the concepts from Gödel, Escherbach all together into this really nice, concise article. So I would recommend everyone checking that out. I'll link to it. And it's definitely related to stuff we're going to talk about today.
I feel like the mandala, that's our, harkening back to the limits of predictability. If you have that model and you have the right initial conditions, we can forecast anything.
Alden, do you have a book or weather report?
I do. I'll combine them into one. So this is a retrospective weather report. Over the past couple winters here in Syracuse, we have had very little snow, which is quite unusual for Syracuse. And it was beginning to feel like that might be the new normal. And then this year was a great reminder that amidst the larger trends, there's lots of variation. And we had some cold weeks in January, early February, days after day where it wouldn't crack like 22 degrees Fahrenheit or something. And amid all that, my sibling gave me this great book for Christmas that is called Moon of the Crusted Snow. And it's what turned out to be a horror or suspense book that I don't know if I would have read if I had knew that it was going to become that, but it pulls you in and you can't stop reading it. It's about a indigenous community way north in Ontario, Canada, and the winter sets in and something happens and they get disconnected from the outside world. Though cold is effectively a character in the book. It totally drives the story and causes the tension and is used to like make your neck just feel so like, oh, it's going to happen. And I was reading this book all right while we're in these really intense cold spells in Syracuse. It was quite an experience, unlike many books that I normally read, but I'd recommend it. Moon of the Crusted Snow.
I love that. I love when the experience of reading a book crosses into reality.
Yeah, I would stay up too late reading it and then realize I still had to take the dog out for her final walk and feel like freezing and looking over my shoulder for what's going to come in the middle of the snow as I'm depths of January.
Yeah, I have some vivid like memories of similar situations. I read The Left Hand of Darkness by my favorite author, Ursula K. Le Guin, and I finished the book and the section where they're like cross-country skiing along this like vast, vast expanse of winter. And it's like crazy endurance challenge for these two protagonists. The next day I had to run an ultra marathon in 2 feet of snow. And it was great. I actually like thought about the book the whole time I ran and it like kept me going. Okay. Let's talk about the paper. Can I read the abstract?
Go for it.
Yeah. Okay, actually, no. I have something before I read the abstract. So again, this is end-to-end data-driven weather prediction published in Nature. I was looking through the author list because some of them were familiar. And first of all, Anna Allen, great job. She also was on Aurora, which I accidentally read because I got confused between the two A letter machine learning papers. I got halfway through and I was like, wait a second, I thought we were doing the end-to-end one.
And the confusion here, I don't think we mentioned this paper, the initial archive print was called Aardvark Weather.
Right.
Aardvark Weather.
Now it's called End-to-End Data-Driven Weather Prediction. The Aurora one is called like a foundational model for Earth, something like that. Anyway, Anna's on both of them, which I realized because I read them both. And great job. Anna and Stratus share credit equally. So they both did equal amounts of work, which I think is a really nice little footnote, high five between two collaborators. It's a pretty great group of authors, and I had a good time going through their prior works and just looking at all their writing and every paper. I was like, wow, I want to read that. I want to read that. I want to read that. So good work, everyone. Okay, abstract. Weather prediction is critical for a range of human activities, including transportation, agriculture, and industry, as well as for the safety of the general public. Machine learning transforms numerical weather predictions, NWP, by replacing the numerical solver with neural networks, improving the speed and accuracy of the forecasting component of the prediction pipeline. However, current models rely on numerical systems at initialization and to produce local forecasts, thereby limiting their achievable gains. Here we show that a single machine learning model can replace the entire NWP pipeline. Aardvark Weather, an end-to-end data-driven weather prediction system, ingests observations and produces global gridded forecasts and local station forecasts. The global forecasts outperform an operational NWP baseline for several variables and lead times. The local station forecasts are skillful for up to 10 days of lead time, competing with a post-processed global NWP baseline and a state-of-the-art end-to-end forecasting system with input from human forecasters. End-to-end tuning further improves the accuracy of local forecasts. Our results show that skillful forecasting is possible without relying on NWP at deployment time, which will enable the realization of the full speed and accuracy benefits of data-driven models. We believe that Aardvark Weather will be the starting point for a new generation of end-to-end models that will reduce computational costs by order of magnitude and enable the rapid, affordable creation of customized models for a range of end users. Alden, Marta, what jumped out at you?
I have a question, and I'd be curious if you all know. Do we know why it's called Aardvark?
I was going to say the same thing.
Did you ask the internet? Because I did.
You did? Okay. You did. Yeah, tell me.
It was such an AI-generated answer. It was insane. It was like, the aardvark is an animal with a long nose that is known for going deep.
Like it snuffles up the in situ?
Exactly. So it goes like deep the way the model goes deep. That was how the Google AI put it all together. But that was a fantastic image. And I liked the metaphor of the length of an aardvark's nose as the length of the end-to-end model.
That's not speaking to me. But
really?
I mean,
it didn't sound so true. It didn't sound like that was the actual intention, but
yeah, I'll reach out to the authors and see if that and confirm it after.
I'd love to know
in post-production.
Yeah. So I think the key thing that stands out here is the completeness, the end-to-end aspect of this, where it's all happening without dependence on some of these traditional numerical weather assimilation and prediction systems that have this characteristic being very useful, but also taking a lot of computational resources and therefore usually time. So, you know, I think like the data assimilation system often will take about three or four hours to run, and then you can start the forecast. And then that takes a few more hours often to run for these, you know, state-of-the-art global models. They hint at some of the key benefits and why people are excited about this whole end-to-end aspect of doing the whole thing in a machine learning or AI type framework, where you can start to make it affordable for more people to run these types of models and customize them for themselves rather than, you know, needing a nation state to get the thing going.
Sort of on the theme of parsimonious.
And I love how it harks back to the our previous paper. So the previous paper is all about how do we correct these initial states that goes into the model. And this paper says, what if we just didn't even take those initial states in at all and went straight to the source, got the observations from the satellites, from the sensors on the ground, from the ships, from the balloons going through the atmosphere, and put those directly into our model and figured out our own states to start this forecast.
And that is one of like the key differences between the end-to-end model and traditional weather forecasting prediction pipeline.
And even how it differs from the new machine learning models that still are reliant on those initializations. So I think it's worth maybe spending a second there just to make sure that's super clear. in traditional numerical weather prediction, you have like all of these steps. You have this cascade of a process of different modules that prepare things for the actual prediction process. And a lot of the machine learning weather models that have come out are still reliant on those first steps and then just replace the solver, the forecaster piece. And this is saying, whoa, that, you know, that's maybe not going far enough. And actually, this, I guess this is as good a time as any to talk about end-to-end. I think there are many ways to define end-to-end and where end begins and where end ends. And some of the smartest people that I talk to, the smartest people who bother talking to me, maybe, like Gray Nearing, Pete Battaglia at Google DeepMind, they all have this same idea, which is to keep expanding that definition of end-to-end as the primary way to do cooler, more powerful stuff. Weather is like an intermediary for a lot of, like in some cases, people just take the output of a weather forecast and use that to make decisions. I would say maybe as often or maybe more often in many hidden ways, you're taking that into another decision framework, model, whatever, and then making another prediction. So is it worth extending the end out further? You know, Gray has talked to us a lot about, Gray Nearing, who's one of Alden and Mai's like mentor, has talked a lot about one unified geophysics model, right? That goes all the way to hydrology and weather and all of that. And that's how you kind of can get the most performance out of it. Other folks I've talked about is like, why do weather and then a like grid model? Just do it all, like do the whole thing in one. There's some very obvious reasons why the end-to-end in this paper is a specific thing. It's the end-to-end of a classical numerical weather prediction pipeline. But I still find it interesting, especially as we start to talk more about the observations that are used and the outputs that they did and didn't pick.
Yeah, totally. There's a couple other areas that, at least in the abstract, they don't touch on that I think make this exciting and why people in the industry are working on models like this. So in addition to that speed and computation and customizability side of things, there's a lot of promise in using these neural networks to process the observations themselves, because we might be able to extract better information out of them and ultimately use that to improve the forecast, the horizon that we can forecast, or improve the spatial resolutions, like the size of the grid cells. You know, it's very difficult to, if you're just going to use, say, your ERA5 as the input to your model or the target to your model, you can't really get a higher resolution model than that. And so if you want a really high spatial resolution model, you've got to go find some data that can, it's giving you observations at a higher spatial resolution. And so going actually out to observations is the real key that the most promising direction to me to actually get these models from their, you know, 0.1 degree, 10 kilometer by 10 kilometer grid cells down to the elusive 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer grid cell that everybody really seems to want.
Yeah, that reminds me of that famous Isaac Newton quote, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulder of ERA 5. No, I'm just kidding. In the first paragraph, though, I was excited by the sentence that says, "Modern systems predict a wide range of variables at lead times of up to 15 days, which is the theoretical limit of medium range weather forecasting predictability citation, so it must be true." You gotta subscribe to our podcast. No, I'm just kidding. This came out before the other paper.
Yeah. I think their first preprint on this was,
a while ago.
End of March 2024. That paper came out last summer.
Yeah.
But that gives you an idea of how pervasive that idea of what is the theoretical limit. You know, it's just widely cited in a paper like this. You'll say, yep, there it is.
Yeah. And
Is that still, though, like the operational limit?
It depends on what time scale you're measuring and exactly what quantity you're verifying against. In many cases, it's worse than that. Yeah. It's 7-5 days. But it's, for example, much harder to say within this 15-minute period, 7 days from now, what's going to happen versus the whole entire day, 7 days from now, what's going to be the, average temperature or something like that.
I did, as we moved through the introduction, I appreciated the kind of imagery they conjured around this pipeline, this like prior numerical weather prediction pipeline, this chain of modules that are feeding one into the next. The challenges that they call out are compelling to me because that kind of modularization on one hand is attractive because you can kind of build tests and verifications along each step. There's sometimes arguments around explainability being better because you can kind of look at these intermediate products. But then the flip side is by going end to end, you don't need these supercomputers. You can develop faster, lightweight, customizable alternatives. Those are, I would say, ancillary benefits to the potential greater benefit, which is why the aforementioned smart people keep talking about expanding the bounds of end to end, not necessarily for those reasons, but for raw performance. And this is something Alden and I have glommed onto a lot. Richard Sutton is a researcher who has done a lot of work in the field of reinforcement learning. And I usually get this wrong, but I'll just say that like Mo Beta is like one of, if you can scale compute, that's how you can increase performance. It's not about injecting human ingenuity, which I actually think this is probably very controversial in the meteorological space still. There are a lot of great papers coming out that talk about hybrid models. I just saw a new effort at NOAA to do like this hybrid physics machine learning thing. But Sutton's bitter truth, is that what it's called, Nolan?
Bitter lesson,
right, is that time and time again, it is proved to us being humans, that we hope that our genius, the human mind, is able to come up with these relationships and connections and elegant solutions, elegant equations that describe reality. But the truth is, those will be outperformed by machines with enough data to reverse engineer the equations.
That's, I think, something that I was thinking about a lot in the end-to-end model, just generally that middle piece where, Marshall, you described it as a loss of explainability. Because I think that my question is, if a model can put out a prediction, that the logic of getting there is obscured and the outcome is not something that we can totally comprehend or understand, but we've gone through a validation process to where we can we trust in the accuracy of it, so we then make decisions off of that prediction. Is that something that concerns people, like the ability to understand it? Are we risking putting out a black box kind of output or a black box prediction?
Uh-oh. You said it. You said the two words, black box.
Is this a hot button thing?
I mean, it is and it isn't. Yeah. I just think it's the objection I hear the most around our hydrology work. And I think it can be true, right? You can train machine learning models that are black boxes. You can also train machine learning models that aren't and do give you those kind of intermediate outputs. Maybe it's not like a series of many models. It's one model that still can give you those intermediate outputs that help you understand why it's saying what it's saying. The thing that claim triggers in me the most is the implication that the alternative is not a black box.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, the language in here, I think you also mentioned it was compelling to you, but that word of chained, the NWPs mm-hmm. chained together. I mean, that still sounds like a massively complex problem to go back and run through and understand.
Yeah. And I think even though it's an end-to-end data-driven model, I think they had steps that could allow for evaluation, like the different layers of taking observations and then assimilating it into a gridded format, right? I think they have those processes that you could still reach into and do the eval and like, is this doing the right thing? But I think that maybe at the higher level, the less like specific claim is just that I don't think there's like this magic debuggability that is present in a human coming up with a set of physics equations or algorithms versus deriving those equations or those algorithms through data. I think that there is still a lot to achieve in terms of explainability in machine learning, but I think a lot of the claims around like it is a black box or you just like cannot understand why it's saying what it's saying is false. Actually, Alden, you might be a co-author on the hydrology version of this. Were you, or was that just Freddie?
That one was just Freddie, but this is a tech. There's many tech. Shout out, Freddie. Hey, there are many techniques to look inside these things. My reaction when I hear it's a black box is generally that just means we haven't done enough work to open up the box and look at what's going on. And there's ways that you can apply, you know, outside to pick things apart. You can just go look exactly right in. Like Marshall was saying, there is a specific encoder module, a processor module, and a decoder module. And you can just go look at the part where the encoder model connects to the processor model and see what's in there. Then you can even change your models to ask them to predict all of these outputs at these intermediate steps in addition to the final answer that you want so that you can effectively follow its chain of processing and thought. So it's possible to make these models a black box and not really look inside them. That's just stopping too soon in my perspective. Just go further and build those tools, ask the model to do more for you. They're actually usually incredibly good at doing that as well. And we should ask for both. We should ask for the performance and flexibility we can get from these and the explainability that's possible too.
Yeah, I'll say too, I think that there is just such a wave of anxiety culturally about AI. And there is so much excitement about AI weather forecasting that I was a little bit surprised to see that anxiety is also present in this field too. And I think something that, Marsha, I feel like you sent this to me was the American Meteorological Society, the theme of their upcoming annual meeting is the human element and slow thinking, which I think is very explicitly reactionary to the fast thinking of these AI models.
I think you should, I really do think you should submit a paper, Marta, and potentially like on weather journaling and getting a community building exercise to get all of these researchers to do weather journaling. I think that would be a really compelling talk. Anyway, to move ahead a little bit, I starred this one section, which I thought was a pretty epic mic drop. In a recent article assessing the prospect of end-to-end deep learning weather prediction, the verdict was that a number of fundamental breakthroughs are needed before this goal comes into reach. Here, we report that these breakthroughs are happening earlier than expected.
we did it. We did all the thing.
Pretty great. Good job, y'all. And then a little bit later, we demonstrate that using an order of magnitude fewer observations than those available to operational baselines and orders of magnitude less computational resources, blah, blah, blah. Can we just talk, what are they using and what could they be using?
So they have kind of two main categories of observations. There's observations that come from a sensor that's in a particular spot. And so that's sensors that are on ships, a station somewhere. There are also sensors that are flying on planes. They didn't use those in this particular one, but that's a great source of data that goes into these traditional numerical models. And then balloons, too, that are let go and float through the atmosphere, sending back their data. Those are super high quality observations, but they're only available at a point. And so the coverage is relatively limited if you think about how massive the Earth's atmosphere is. But they have this quality of, it's a quality over quantity thing. And then there's the other side, which is the satellite observations. So these are coming from low Earth orbit satellites or medium Earth orbit satellites that are looking down at the Earth and the atmosphere and have different types of sensors to tell you things about how the winds are moving around at the ocean. Those are the scatterometers, or what moisture is in the atmosphere, the 3D profiles of the atmosphere. And while those observations are more coarse, all those point measurements from that first category, those are concentrated where people who have resources are. And the satellites, on the other hand, are seeing effectively the whole Earth or the whole atmosphere.
And there's so much cool work going on in this space by large and small groups alike. Just to give some of those groups a shout out, there's Windborne. I don't know these folks personally yet. I'm sure we'll run into each other at some point, but they're releasing balloons. That's their whole theory of like, oh, can we release more balloons? And I think they're trying to use it in an end-to-end.
Yeah, they talk about a model that actually then assimilates those and actually is a product you can get.
And then there's Brightband, which is obviously trying to make use of maybe some of the untapped observations here, doing some really cool work. And they're all great folks there. I'm pretty confident something cool is going to come out of that shop soon based on their AMS talk.
Zeus AI.
Yep.
Doing a similar process there of taking these raw observations and going to either a short-term forecast or an analysis. A fun one is there's a company called Care Weather that makes these tiny scatterometer satellite, which is just kind of a wild thing that you can have a smart startup of a couple people and be a company that makes satellites and delivers satellite data. It's just kind of wild. But they're another example of the ASCAT satellites that they're pulling data in from here. They're trying to complement that and really increase that coverage. Actually, if you look at that figure on figure one, they shove a map of this ASCAT data, and you see there's all these slices and holes in there. And that's actually all the data you get in 24 hours. So there's just these gaps over the ocean where for hundreds of kilometers, nobody knows what the winds are out there. And this is an example of folks saying, we could actually probably make a fairly low cost satellite and fill in those gaps.
But keeping going on the observation theme, There's a section a little later that says, a key challenge in designing machine learning systems for observational atmospheric data is that the records for many instruments are relatively short, limiting the data available for training. The modular design of Aardvark addresses this issue by enabling pre-training using high-fidelity historical reanalysis data before fine-tuning on scarcer observational data. I found that interesting, and I think that's a huge challenge, not just in the record length, but in just how diverse the challenges are going to be with each observational data set, whether it's gaps or bias that's hard to detect, or it goes offline, or it has a short history. I mean, all of those things make this probably the hardest problem of this is in every case with machine learning, no matter how sophisticated you get, it gets back to how good are you at dealing with messy, messy data.
Yeah, there's a reason why the first wave of these AI numerical weather models didn't do this, because it's a lot of work to just get to that point. Starting with a nice clean ERA5 initial state is great. Although I was kind of surprised that they are both talking about the limited amount of data, but then later go on to say that they're actually only using about 8% of the data available to traditional numerical weather prediction models of this type of data. I was like, wait a minute, which one is it? But to be fair, this is a proof that this stuff is possible, not a, this is how you should go out and do it in the real world operationally.
Aardvark Prime is coming. Oh, before we get to performance, the thing that first caught my attention when I was reading this paper was that they did not do precipitation.
Yes.
Which is, you know, I was looking at this, getting really excited, and I was like, oh, that's what I want. I want the rain. Do you have any insight into why they skipped that?
My hunch is that is because it is hard. It's really tough.
Do you think they did it and then just didn't want to publish it because the performance wasn't good? Or do you think they just didn't even try it? I would be disappointed if it were the former.
I don't know, but it is, precipitation is both one of the most valuable outputs you can get out of these models and one of the trickiest things to predict because it is so variable. It's this signal, you know, a temperature signal has a nice normal distribution. Precipitation is this time series where that's 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, massive value, swinging all around, 0, 0, 0s again. Those super variable time series are just really tricky to predict. And the observations are more sparse. When I was looking up the satellites they used, the big thing that I saw after on the same similar theme, Marshall, is there's a whole bunch of really great satellites out there that are all about measuring water in the atmosphere, ice crystals in the atmosphere, all of that. Many of those didn't make it into this one, but I'm sure that is where people in the industry who are looking at, you know, how do you take this idea and make it into a reality are wanting to pull those satellites in, like the Joint Polar JPSS. That's a great one that's running now. It's a NOAA and some other organization collaboration. There's like a wealth of data in there that's going to be really cool to see people use in this type of process.
Yeah. I just wish, you know, in the abstract, it said explicitly the global forecasts outperform an operational NWP baseline for several variables and lead time. And it just goes back to my one critique that is pervasive for all of these, which is, okay, you said that, but you didn't say that you didn't do precip. It's just like, yeah, you could slice it. You could always slice it some way to make that claim something you could toss in the abstract. In here, it is warranted, right? The model is great and does a good job, but I kind of want to enact a ban on the claim of for some horizons and some variables we were more accurate. It's started to become meaningless to me in these kinds of papers, even if it's you get into it later on and you can verify it. Oh, okay, in these situations it does seem a little bit more accurate. Reading that without understanding that the precipitation wasn't in the picture, it tempers it a little bit.
To be fair, Marta Marshall and I are biased toward the importance of precipitation given our day jobs of predicting water in rivers.
But and my pumpkins in the garden?
Yeah, it really impacts everything. It is such an important output of these models.
Yeah, quick side note, Tennessee gardening is so easy compared to Boston. Oh my gosh. My pumpkin plants are growing like 2 feet a day. It's actually outrageous. Meadow, my daughter, literally poured the bag of squash seeds out. And I was like, no, 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 wait. And she just poured it out. We have done nothing to it. It's been raining a lot. And there are full-grown squash plants now. It's just so easy. In Boston, I was like, it was a constant struggle to make anything live in the short growing season we had. Anyway, sorry.
Really gives you empathy for the people pre-grocery stores and large-scale farming living in the north.
Yeah, definitely.
So turning to the eval here, big takeaways here, if you kind of to summarize this up, is this model is a little bit worse than ECMWF's model and a little bit better than NOAA's GFS model. So it falls somewhere in between.
For the
variables that we talk about, which are, to be fair, outside of precipitation, some of the most important ones.
Definitely.
Not seeing solar radiation on there, which is, you know, critical and becoming more important as solar becomes a big generation source for humanity. But temperature and wind at the surface are, those are key and very important for all of us. The GFS comparison was actually a new addition in the Nature paper. It was not in the original paper. And
so they referenced that. They're like, yeah, GFS isn't, we don't think it's the best, but we had to include it because it's a baseline that everyone else uses.
Yeah. It also makes them, it also brackets them and makes their, you know, performance be between not just worse than the other comparison. There's a, so Stefan Rasp is another weather modeling researcher who pays a lot of attention to this, works at Google, and he maintains this great plot that actually is comparing all of these papers. X-axis is the year that the paper came out, and the y-axis is how good is this model at that big geopotential variable up way in the atmosphere? How good is it relative to ECMWF's model? And that's like the line, and that's going running horizontally. And the general trend is, a number of years ago, all the papers are a little bit worse and they go up and up and up and up and up. And now nobody publishes a paper that's worse than the ECMWF's model, except for, then you drop down to the bottom right of the plot, these end-to-end models. So the interesting thing is, like, these models are actually at the moment the only numerical weather prediction models that people are publishing about that are doing worse than the ECMWF's model. But that gives you kind of an idea of the excitement and the potential people see for these, because they say it's worth talking about, even though we haven't yet figured out how to beat the current gold standard. There's more work to be done, but it's that exciting of a direction to head in.
Yeah, totally. The end-to-end is the next step change in our forecasting ability. The end users might see these short-term gains and be like, oh no, like I just want this model on top of Era 5. It's going to eke me out the most performance for my end user decision. But I think everyone in the field is like, end-to-end's where it's at. We got to make use of all these obs. So going back to the observations for a second, I think there are a couple of interesting topics there maybe to bring us home. The first is I really liked their encoder module ablation section. They have a really good matrix in the paper that shows, like, what if we didn't use satellites? What if we didn't use in situ? It gives you a good matrix across the variables of what impacts. Satellites are the biggest one. Like, satellites are most important. I was actually a little surprised. They say in situ is really important for surface variables. I was a little surprised to see that there wasn't more contribution from the in situ measurements. I think that comes back to like how they then show some stuff around like tuning the model for a specific station. So like, oh, let's make a forecast just for this station, and that's cool. But I guess that just caught me off guard. I would have expected the in situ to contribute more skill than the skim of the matrix makes me feel like it does.
Yeah. It was also interesting that when the loss of the in-situ measurements has the most impact on these pressure level variables, these geopotential heights that are high up in the atmosphere, that was counterintuitive to me. I would have thought that these, you know, most of these in-situ measurements that they're talking about are on the ground. I would have thought that would have the most impact on the wind on the ground, the accuracy on the wind on the ground, the temperature on the ground, but apparently not. Pretty interesting.
After that ablation test, they talk about the station forecasting. So, quote, in less well-resourced areas, although agencies have access to global products, they often do not have access to comparable infrastructure to run HRES, local NWP, or post-process forecasts to a comparable degree. And they go on to say, Aardvark is a really great tool where you actually can go and tune it to a specific station's observations and create like a local forecast that's really good for your place. It may not perform well everywhere, but it's going to be good for your place. And I think that's a theme that we've been excited about when it comes to all of these different machine learning models, is that democratization of technology. And I still think I can't imagine that this is trivial to set up, or it's like trivial to tune it for a station, but I think it's a really exciting step. And they do another one of these matrices where they show that downscaling error for different regions. And I thought that was a cool way to demonstrate the capability here, the potential here,
This is very analogous to what we do with our river models that start out with some foundation model that is globally applicable and then fine-tune it to the particular watersheds. They're really like painting this vision with this section of the paper where they do this fine-tuning to a certain task. And in this case, it's the certain task of predicting temperature and and wind at stations, ground stations. But you could imagine that task is a totally different thing. Like it could be predict the energy demand at a city or a whole number of other downstream tasks. And it makes me wonder, the jury for me is still out about whether that is going to be the future that we're looking toward, where, you know, every organization is running five different of their own models tuned to their own purposes. Or are we going to go to a world where there are still a number of providers who are making a suite of really good models, and then people are taking those and maybe they're adding their own kind of very simple additional or relatively simple additional decision-making processes off the end of them. Yeah. And I'm not sure which way the world is headed.
Or is it one or a couple sent like in the pattern of the LLMs? Is it like a bunch of giga models that can tell you whatever you want, but like it's all encoded in what they have seen?
Yeah. And the jury, even in the LLM world, is the pendulum seems to be swinging back and forth. You know, for a while there was everybody's like, you know, Facebook released their Llama model and everybody can run their own one. And then that started to fall behind what was coming out of the biggest AI labs. But I would not be surprised that pendulum swings back eventually as the open source things start to learn from what the biggest labs have done.
Yeah. I would imagine that the Aardvark team and other folks doing end-to-end modeling in the weather space envy the simplicity of a language model and just scraping the internet for text. I mean, obviously, there's a lot there that I'm glossing over in terms of the complexity of filtering out the text you don't want to learn from. But in the same way, if it's hard downloading, like we started Dynamical because it's hard to download the end product, getting in-situ measurements, boat data, aircraft data. I mean, there's some great initiatives that have made that a little bit more homogenous and accessible, but I can't imagine it's easy at all. So back to the weather station I operated at my house in Massachusetts, I was able to register it with this National Weather Service registry so that it would be part of a data set that could be used to calibrate weather models. And as part of that, they wanted me to like test it to make sure that it didn't have bias. And it actually was really revealing to me because I looked at other hobbyist weather stations around me, and some people who were like 1,000 meters away had totally different temperature readings, degrees off. And it really called the question like, okay, is it because it's in shade, or is it because like, and I can't even imagine starting to get to that. And I think we're going to have to do a whole episode with some experts, maybe some guests on that can get to like, what is truth? You know, what is real? Can we measure? You know, back to my claim that if we have a perfect representation of the initial conditions, we can model weather perfectly. That's not possible. Like, clearly not possible. There's always going to be sensor error. There's always going to be gaps. We can't like contiguously measure everything. So I think that's going to be a fascinating next step as we try to go from 8% to 20% to 50% of the data that's available. That comes with all of these challenges around, well, I have to throw away half of it anyway because I can't know that it's representative of truth. And that's going to be a real headache.
Real headache. Because the thing is, your sensor and that neighbor sensor, they might have both been right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of variability.
It definitely made me doubt.
Yeah. And then you go back and you think about the truth that this model, this paper is evaluating against. Is there's one pixel for most of your entire city. And that is the single truth value there. As this end-to-end weather prediction modeling advances, I think we really need to be evaluating against station observations.
Yeah.
Because using the truth here as a modeled output from a different weather model that we all know throws away a lot of important information that's in those initial observations, these models may be doing even better, but you wouldn't be able to see it when your target isn't an observation out in the world that you're evaluating right. against. It's a model that has like has the same flaws that you're trying to overcome with the model that you're making right now.
I think in some way that maybe challenges the excitement that we feel about the democratization of the model. There's a limiting factor in those on the ground weather station observations. And so even if it can work with sparse data, can be tuned to those localizations, there's still an infrastructure bottleneck.
I underlined that.
Yeah, me too.
It is also important to consider how data from new instruments for which there are no training data available can be usefully integrated into the system. This can be accomplished by, for example, training on simulated data. That's really, I think, going to be one of the gnarliest challenges about how we put these models into practice and then improve them, as inevitably we want to make new sensors or our old satellites are decommissioned. That process is very tricky, and there's approaches and ways to start integrating these things, even as they don't have as much of a long record. And they do some of that in this paper, but the details there are very tricky to take advantage, to really squeeze the juice out of a new observation without a very long history there. So that it's going to be quite a lot of work. It'll be interesting to see how that niche of this niche within this niche evolves.
Yeah. I guess one thing, so we're pretty much at the end of the paper. When do we start operationalizing these models, right? So when they're done as part of this paper, they're not running operationally. These are, you know, one-time evaluations. The code is usually published. It's somewhere. And I was wondering, do you think anyone out there is like running a private aardvark model for themselves or their organization? Do you think there's like one or three people out there, or is it zero?
Gotta say, I would not be surprised if it was zero. You know, so for some of these other models that don't need quite as diverse a set of inputs because they're just taking ECMWF's initial conditions and running from there, you know, that's something that you can go download a file and get going.
Yeah, but there are definitely some like nerds at hedge funds who are running Graphcast to
totally
do their thing, for sure. Yeah.
I mean, this one, like, you know, some of these satellites, they're decommissioned. They had a great long training history to use in this paper, but the satellite has been replaced. And there's a different sensor that's similar, but it's not exactly the same. That's not a trivial thing to just pick it up and start using it.
So I guess the call to action is, it would be great. I don't know if we could do this with Dynamical. I would like to, but it's probably hard. It'd be great if there was like an organization that was not just like WeatherBench and WeatherBench 2 are awesome projects, but they are usually looking back at evals. My dream is that there exists someone who's running all of them and doing live evals at different geographies, different weather variables. So you could, you know, MARTA, look at your weather journal and then the next day look back and see how your weather journal compared to all of the aardvark, Graphcast, HRES.
Yes.
Yeah. So closing thoughts.
My experience building machine learning models is that you can play with the architecture of your model and all your hyperparameters for hours and days, and you will not make a very large change in what you get out. What you can do that's most valuable is get new, better, higher quality information into the model. And that's what really gets me excited about this approach, is it's a blueprint for how these AI weather prediction models can take new high quality information and feed it into these really important models.
I think my final thoughts are still, I think that my brain is really stuck in that question of explainability. And I'm glad that you all covered quite a bit of the paper while I was sitting here contemplating this. And it seems to me that explainability piece is like a value that needs to be set or stated and might not be equally shared by everyone. Mm. And I'd be really curious to see, you know, do we operationalize these models before we have that piece, or is that part of operationalizing? Mm. And yeah, I mean, there's so much happening in the field of AI ethics. And I think that these predictions, like both in weather and water, like there's so much consequential outcomes of how we react to what the predictions are. So that would be
absolutely
my question is that explainability piece a value, and how does it look? I'd be very curious to hear about that.
I mean,
more.
I think that's so interesting, because it's also, there are layers of explainability. Explainable to whom? I feel like there's probably a whole study on this. We should find a paper and do it. But like, what are the layers of explainability, starting from the researchers who build the model? What do they need explained to them to have confidence in how the model is making decisions? To other researchers, how do you make other people trust what you've done is good? To sophisticated consumers, like corporations that want to leverage what you've built to make better decisions, to end users. And like, all of those different pieces of explainability are probably totally separate. For the end user piece, I imagined NOAA and other weather agencies, weather bureaus have probably done an immense amount of like centuries of research since back when NOAA was the weather bureau. Their whole thing was like, no one trusts us. Everyone thinks we're full of shit. Like, what do we do? And I imagine through that transformation to being a trusted source of information, they've probably done untold amounts of work around end user trust and explainability towards that trust. And I think the communication departments of like NASA and USGS and NOAA are like top notch and really great.
Yeah, I would say they probably have a lot to do with that trust. And I think the end user piece is sort of interesting, because I wonder if many of these models are being run by private entities, like how much of that explainability comes in like this sort of ad hoc process. Like, you have one customer who's more risk averse than another and who needs it. But that, in that reality, we are still operating the models without having a embedded process of opening up the box, like Alden mentioned, which is, I mean, that's fascinating to me, and makes me think of like the classical definitions of science and technology. Like, classically, science is a movement to understand the world, and technology is this movement to control it. And throughout history, these things have become interwoven. And typically, though, the trend is that the science presses forward and propels the technology. And to go back and to look for explainability, that would be technology propelling science, I think, which is interesting in and of itself, regardless of any of the ethical questions.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, super fascinating. And this is a direction I would love to go explore further on this podcast. One of my favorite sessions at AMS this past winter was basically that kind of that first step that Marshall was describing. It was other researchers looking and seeing if they can explain models made by other people or understand what's going on with them. So it's people running existing AI models. These people had a little bit more of an atmospheric science background than a machine learning background. And they were basically trying to dig into them and diagnose from the outputs, like, are they capturing these processes? What processes in like atmospheric scientist speak, are they missing? And it was pretty interesting. A nice like first step down that direction. One of my favorite sessions. But I could also see, you know, all the people from DeepMind sitting in the audience, and I was just imagining what was going through their head. They're like, "You guys are picking apart my model GraphCast from like 3 years ago. Like, of course it's got this problem. I've got three models since then, guys." But it was pretty interesting to see people who really did understand atmospheric science be able to identify, like, in the language of atmospheric science, these are like the processes that these models are getting right, and this is where they're like falling down, which can help actually tell you what new observations we should get that can explain or provide context on the processes that are not doing well at the moment and add those in.
Yeah. We should figure out how to dive deeper into this topic, but the question I will leave us with relates to your points, Marta, which I think are incredible. I want to believe that explainability is different from accuracy, but I think to the end user, the more right something is, the less they care about understanding what's under the hood. Mm. And so I do wonder if we had a, let's say, perfect forecast out 10 days of weather, would anyone care from the end user perspective about how it's giving you that answer? And I'm not sure. I'm not sure if we really have explainability now with any of our weather models. I think a lot of people are like, "Oh, I don't trust anything. I just look at the radar."
Right.
So I think that there's trust through accuracy. And we dunk on these claims of like this monoculture of focusing on these accuracy gains measured against AR5. But I think there's something there that maybe relates to how end users are going to trust these models. But then at the same time, we want to open the hood to make them more explainable and like the different modules understand the different steps. And I think that might be good further up the chain of explainability, but I do wonder if the end user cares or will ever care, or if that would even help build trust.
Yeah, I mean, I fear that what happens in practice is that when we act on a forecast that ends up being bad information, or there ends up being an instance of inaccuracy, the decision-making ends up in some sort of catastrophe. And then we have to go back and place accountability. And yeah, that accountability lies somewhere in a neural network. And that's when we come up with more of a process around it, and we state how much we care.
I guess the question, though, is like, is that any different from a pre-neural network world?
Right. No, that's what I was going to say. I don't think it is. I think that's how a lot of our ethical standards have been created.
I love these points. I would love to. We should spend 17 episodes on this stuff.
17. All right. So in part one of our 17-part special coming up. All right, let's call it here. Thanks to the authors of this paper. Thanks for everyone foolish enough to listen to our podcast. If you have any recommendations for papers, definitely reach out. We will see you next time.
Woo! See you next time.
Adieu.